All right, guys, welcome back to another episode of Persuasion by the Pint. I'm Jonathan Taylor, along with
Sean McCool, and we have a special guest with us today that we mentioned last week, Mr. Josh Burnoff.
Yes. It's great to see you.
Appreciate you coming on today, Josh.
Haven't heard that applause in a while. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, you get a fake applause on our show, so... So we've been teasing this last week. We were hoping last week, I know your schedule didn't work out, so we're happy that you could join us this week, because Sean and I have been going through your book, Writing Without Bullshit. So you just gave us an explicit rating for that title alone.
It's a little ghetto I've grown used to living with since I wrote the book.
So, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking today on the show. I highlighted a phrase here that I really liked. And we're going to be going on a journey to clarity, candor, and integrity as far as your writing is concerned. I love that subhead. That was a good, good subhead. So that's the journey we're going to be on. And we're going to learn more about Josh and why he wrote this book and what we can learn from it. And but before we do, we've got a little segment here. We got to get into some beverages and talk that part of the shop.
Absolutely.
Josh, we usually let the guests go first on whatever beverage they're having, whether it's whatever it is. So what do you got? What beverage are you having today?
Well, historically, and I don't think it's going to change because I'm 61 years old now, I have not actually enjoyed alcoholic beverages very much, but I do like the taste of a beer. So what we have here is your good old O'Doul's, available in many supermarkets.
There you go.
Quite refreshing. This is cold and I just finished a long walk, so I deserve it. So here's to everybody. You drink what you want, but this is what I'm drinking today.
And I like it.
I have not been paid a fee by Anheuser-Busch.
That would be nice, right? And if we had.
The first O'Doul's I ever had was in basic training.
So had to hang with the boys.
That's right.
Weren't old enough.
weren't quite old enough. So that first trip to the PX when we had some free time was getting in an O'Doul's, because it made you feel like you were drinking, you know?
Right.
So...
cover the label up with your hands.
I can't resist telling you this. I took a trip a while ago, obviously, before we all became locked down. And I stopped at this sort of brew pub type place just to get something to eat. And I ordered an O'Doul's. And the woman came over to me and she said, before I can deliver it to you, I need to see some ID. And I'm like, let's be clear here. I'm 61 years old and this is a you need an ID before you can serve a 61 year old person a non-alcoholic beer. She's like, well, we have our rules. So.
Wow. That is a strange one.
So it must contain a trace bit of alcohol.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It does contain a small amount, but if it comes from the bar, that's what they have to do.
Okay.
That is crazy. So, all right, Jonathan, you want to go next?
Sure. I will go. I've got a Anderson Valley Old Fashioned brew here from Anderson Valley Brewing Company. Okay. And just to give you a little background. So this is a 8.3% there, Sean.
All right.
And it is a bourbon barrel. Inspired by a love for the classic bourbon cocktail, this robust brown ale is brewed with orange peel, Hirschbrucker hops. Never. Do you know what a Hirschbrucker?
I do not.
Hirschbrucker?
No. We'll have to do a whole
episode. It's an animal that's native to Australia, actually.
So. Oh, okay. Well, there we go.
Now I made that up.
Hey, it sounded believable, right?
Yes. Well, I'm an expert on bullshit, after all. Yeah.
Orange flavors, fresh cherry puree is also added. So, be interesting. Yeah. Cause it's got the IBUs is like 45. So,
you've been reaching a little bit on your last few selections, you know?
Josh, we don't care for IPAs on this show. They're a little too bitter for us, but I've been pushing the envelope here a little with these, with some of these beers lately. So
some of these fruity beers, I thought that was my realm, but you're filling this place nicely. So, all right. I've got a Harveston Old Engine Oil Engineer's Reserve. I couldn't resist the name. Old Engine Oil.
Old Engine Oil.
Old Engine Oil. So it's a blackest ale. Malt chocolatey, roasty. See what it says. The intensely flavored but incredibly smooth Engineer's Reserve is our fabulous Old Engine Oil, brewed up to 9% alcohol by volume. 3 hop varieties, grassy Fugles, spicy East Kent Goldlings, and fruity Galena are combined with roast barley, providing a slightly burnt, toasted coffee character. Enjoy a bottle after dinner and take time to savor the earthy hop, fruity flavors of this particularly dark, rich beer.
I hear a lot of jargon on there. I do believe, hear a lot Josh. Of jargon.
That really sounds like it's going to taste like bicycle grease. I got to tell you.
It does. Right. They kind of lost me with the burnt taste. Like,
yeah, I was going to say burnt. It's like, oh, we burnt it. What are we going to do? We'll make it sound like we did it on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, roasted is one thing, but to actually use the word burnt seems a little...
All right, let's take a look at it.
Great. So it's a black...
Oh, yeah. Wow, that's an oil look.
So this isn't a stout. I mean, this is an ale. This is a black ale. Blackest ale to be. So cheers to everyone.
Cheers. Okay.
There we go.
All right, thoughts? We've already gotten some feedback on the old duels. So
mine's actually very good. It's a it's what I'd expect from a black ale. It's just, you know, not too burnt. I don't taste burnt popcorn, so that's good. No, it's actually, I'd give it a solid 3. So we have a scale, you know, 3 out of 5. Five out of 5.
Pints. Okay. 3 out of 10 would be very sad.
Yeah, no, 3 out of 5. We had a 1 on a couple weeks ago.
So. Oh, yeah. And that was generous.
Yeah.
This is a little too bitter for me. The orange and the cherry, a little too strong, a little tart. So I'm going to give it a 2-2.
Yeah. You should stay away from the fruity beers. It sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what I was thinking. I just see bourbon. That's all I saw was bourbon barrel. Yeah. And so I just neglected all the other copy on there.
Yeah. All right.
Well, time to get into our topic at hand. Josh, if you would, before we get into your book, Writing Without Bullshit, again, we won't change our wording because we're not going to do your book a disservice by using the letters BS.
Okay.
But give us a little background on yourself. And I know you work with a lot of writers out there. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, when I started in my schooling, I had the idea I was going to be a mathematician. But after 3 years in the PhD program at MIT, I said, I have to do something that more people care about here. So I worked for some startup companies. Then I spent 20 years as an analyst at Forrester Research. That's a place where people go for insights. There's a real focus on clear communication, and the research reports are things that people pay thousands of dollars for. Mm-hmm. So if you're working on one of those, there's not a whole lot of tolerance for just like making up little cliches and stuff like that. I published a book while I was there with Charlene Lee and other analysts called Groundswell. And that book was very popular. It's the first real book about social media and how businesses could use it. Sold 150,000 copies. And at that point, I had a lot of freedom about what to do. I worked with people on other books at the end of my career at Forrester. And then when I left Forrester, I said, what do I know that's useful to people who'd be interesting to work on?
Yeah.
And I thought about all the communication I had received there, both from people internally and what I estimate were about 10,000 press releases from various technology companies attempting to convince me that they had the greatest thing ever. I said, you know what? We need to get people to understand the difference between actual communication that's clear and is free of elements that clouded up and bullshit. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that I had to call it bullshit because anything else would not really be doing justice to what we all have to struggle through when we communicate.
Right.
So that's how I wrote that book. It's based on the principles that I learned over my whole career, including the 20 years at Forrester. And it's interesting when I shopped it to publishers, people were saying, oh, you can't really use that word. And then the publisher I worked with, I said, you okay with the title? And they said, well, we saw your book proposal and I don't think you can call it anything else. So that's where the book came from. And if people are interested in learning more, I actually blog about 1,000 words every weekday at withoutbullshit.com. So that's why I can't advertise my blog on Facebook, because they don't like that word,
but right. It's
out there for people who want to subscribe. Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, I would have never guessed that, you know, there would be a mathematician at the root of a book about writing.
Yeah.
Well, it is partly about a very logical way of thinking.
Sure.
Right. I mean, when you remove the bullshit, what you're left is logic. You're left with facts and strategy and persuasion. You're not allowed to just say things are great because that's not something you can get at and or
can't quantify that.
Yeah. And it's funny. I remember when I started at Forrester, one of the first things we did was to do a projection. This was in 1995, and we were projecting the size of the online advertising business, which at the time was negligible, but we thought would get really big. And my boss said, "Well, I'll do the projection." I'm like, okay. And then I looked at what she had come up with, and it's like, you just multiplied the number of impressions you thought people would have by the amount you think people will pay per impression. You know what? I think with the math background I have, I can do things more sophisticated than that.
Sure.
And it's been true throughout my career that while I'm not a mathematician, that type of logical thinking has been extremely helpful and useful.
Yeah, it does explain the equation right at the front of the book, the first few pages of the book. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that? You have an equation actually for writing without bullshit, whether it's just what clear writing is. Like you simplified it.
Yes, that's right. And it's not a very complicated equation. This is what we call the meaning ratio. Because what I realized was that if you look at any piece of communication, there are words in it that actually carry meaning. And then there are words that are just not doing anything. They're the bullshit words. Mm-hmm. And so the meaning ratio is simple. The numerator is the words that carry meaning and the denominator is the total number of words. And when I've looked at communications from people, if your meaning ratio is 80% or above, that's excellent. If it's 70 to 80%, that's pretty good. But anything below 70%, when people read it, something happens in the back of their mind. They're like, what is this about? What is he trying to say? What is she getting at here? What is all this extra stuff? So if you can boost up your meaning ratio of what you're working on, then you can get to the point where people don't interpret what you're trying to convince them of as bullshit.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting because as a writer, copywriter, one thing I was trained to do was use like an FK score, you know, which is different because it's not going to know the difference between a useless word or a, you know, a fluff word, bullshit word versus, you know, one that's not. But same kind of idea, like putting a mathematical formula to your writing so that it's more clear, more concise, and more powerful, easier to read and all that. So I love that idea. You don't happen to have any software that does that, do you?
No, it's challenging because there's a little bit of art to understanding which words have meaning.
Right.
It's interesting when I blog, the blogging software actually will give me a score on the readability of what I'm writing.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's good and sometimes it's not good at all. But if you look at my blog, many of the posts take a piece of communication and sort of show it and then take apart why it's a problem. Mm-hmm. If I've embedded some horrible piece of writing in the middle of my explanation, it doesn't know the difference. And it's like, this is really terrible. I'm like, that's the
point. Yeah. That's why I'd say, that would be anytime you're doing that kind of stuff, it obviously skews your results for sure. But it's a great rule of thumb though. So Jonathan, I know you got a whole notebook full of questions, so I'm going to let you kind of lead.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I was listening. One thing that made me think about our interview today, I was listening to a podcast with Scott Adams this week, and he was noting this is a trained journalist too, that he was referencing an article, and the topic of the article wasn't important as so much as what he mentioned in it, which he said at the very end of the article, the author or the journalist used the term at the end of the day. So, and he's like, that's really lazy writing. And it's just a fluff, you know, stuff that's just pretty much lazy especially when you're thinking of somebody that's in trained journalist or reporter writing who does this on a regular basis and uses that kind of fluffery, then it's pretty bad.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because when you mention that, I flash back to the first time I heard that phrase.
Yeah.
It was probably 28 years ago, the CEO of the company I was working for at the time said at the end of the day, something or other. And I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? What does that mean?
Right.
And we got the cliches were beaten out of us at Forrester. You were not allowed to do those things.
Right.
And I do that now. I probably 75% of my work is editing books and blog posts written by other people. And I'll just like say, no, you're not allowed to say that.
Sure.
That's just a cliche. And, you know, that's basically, if you're telling people things that they already know, mm-hmm. Now, if you're saying, well, the key here is you have to hire smart people.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought I was supposed to hire dumb people. Thank you so much for explaining that. You know, anything that qualifies as, you know, of course, we all know that. Get enough sleep and you'll be better off.
Sure.
Oh, right. Get enough sleep. Why didn't I think of that? Right. So yes, the meaningless platitudes and the cliches really got very little tolerance for that.
And if you read articles today, I mean, there's so much out there. You know, we're just inundated with stuff, and it's a lot of it's clickbait today that people are attracted to from mm-hmm. the article titles, and they follow some of the practices you talk about in your book, like using bullets and things like that to you know, chunk their writing. But at the end of the day, there's so much fluff and just garbage.
Did you do that on purpose?
Yeah.
At the end of the day, there's so much fluff.
That was a little hypnosis right there.
Okay. You know, hypnotic. If you're going to write something, there's really only two things that are worth writing. One is if you have original knowledge or reporting or data that isn't available anywhere else, then go for it.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a friend who's a researcher knowledgeable about podcasts, and they do surveys. They have all this information that's just excellent. I'm like, okay, that costs a lot, but that is really worth it. And that's not the only thing you can do. If you are going to assemble things that have already been known and then have a unique perspective on it, well, that's excellent too. Mm-hmm. If you're just going to tell me the same crap that I'm reading anywhere else, why am I even bothering reading what you wrote?
Right.
Yeah, and that's tough because that's how a lot of the big media, I mean, they're all using the APY or they're just maybe, you know, spinning the title a little bit. Most of them are just repeating the same stuff over and over and over. So why don't, Josh, why don't you kind of tell us like why the book came about and the problem you saw and kind of put some numbers. I know you did some research and you got statistics and studies, just how bad and how deep the bullshit is.
Yeah. So partly related to what I just said, as a former researcher, I felt like I couldn't really have an effective opinion on this unless I had some data. So I did a survey of over 500 people who were business writers. Now, business writers were defined extremely broadly. This is anybody who spends at least 2 hours a week on writing in addition to the time that they spend on email. But really, a lot of business people are in that situation, whether you're writing reports or strategy documents or marketing pieces. And one of the questions I asked these people was, do you agree or disagree with the following statement? Poorly written material wastes a lot of my time. And 81% of the people said that they agreed with that. Now, being a former analyst, I did a little bit of analysis. I looked at all of the job descriptions in the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So basically every job classification. And then I looked at how much time they spend reading, how much of that time was wasted, and how much they got paid. And it might not surprise you to learn that the more people get paid, the more likely they are to spend a lot of time reading. So I calculated that the total cost of the time spent in America on poorly written material is $396 billion. Which is 6% of all wages paid in the United States.
Wow.
So that's the problem I set out fix was to get people to not waste other people's time. The mm-hmm. the iron imperative, which is in the book, is that you have to treat the reader's time as more valuable than your own. And when you're reading something and you're like, this is a waste of my time, that's because the person who wrote it didn't obey that imperative.
Sure. Yeah.
And that is like you said, like, I work with a couple different clients that have Slack channels, mm-hmm. you know, and we think of that as technology and a, you know, a technology platform, but it's just writing, right? I mean, it's all there is there is a bunch of written messages back and forth between people all day long. And literally, with some clients, it's, you know, it's 6, 7, 8 hours of the workday, you know, on a 10-hour day is ciphering through Slack messages, you know, it's crazy. So you made that point that like most of the way we communicate these days is, in text of some form, but the bigger problem, and if you'll address this, is that we're seeing it on electronic screens on glass.
Yeah.
Talk about a little bit about why that's a problem, and what you found in the research there.
Yeah. So for anyone who went to college or even high school, you get trained to write a certain way. Mm-hmm. First of all, you're getting trained by people who are English majors and are used to writing literary criticism. So already they're sort of training you in things like passive voice that are common in academic writing, but don't really fly in the business world. But the other thing is that we're using methods of learning that were started for people who were reading in print. Mm-hmm. But you're probably not writing a book. You're writing an email. You're writing a memo. Even if you're writing a document, it may be, it's likely to be read by people in the form of an online PDF. Right. And I actually interviewed experts on online reading. And what they told me is that you just cannot get the same level of concentration on online material on a screen as you can from print. And that just makes it even more imperative that people come directly to the point, that they're extremely clear and that they don't have these bullshit elements in their writing. And yet that's not what we were trained for. I have to, every time, I mean, we had lots of recent college graduates at Forrester Research that were doing the entry-level research jobs. And they were very smart people, but we had to untrain them in the way they'd been trained to write and get them to learn to write in a new, much clearer way.
Sure.
Because that's what people really needed.
I mean, that's interesting because it explains why. So both 7th and 10th grade, I failed English and I flunked out as an English major in college. And now I write copy for a living. So I think they call that irony. I'm not sure.
They call that the skills you needed were not the skills that you were learning in school. That's what
exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, when I read that, you know, about the glass screens, I kind of knew that intuitively, mm-hmm. like that it was much harder to focus. And I think I've read some stuff in the past where literally like just a book, because you can actually see it in space, your brain absorbs it differently than like a flat one-dimensional screen.
Yep.
So yeah, it's a big, big problem because, and the screens are getting smaller.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, so it's getting harder and harder to focus. You got to have reading glasses like this now as you get older. It's crazy.
Right. So, right. And now you got your kid screaming in your ear while you're trying to work. So
yeah. So what are the solutions? How do we write better, and how do we spread this mission across the world?
Well, there's a reason I wrote the book the way I did, which is in about 30 short chapters, because the solution is not some overarching thing. It's to identify the individual bits and pieces and start working on them.
Okay.
So for example, the first and most important thing is to just write fewer words. The number one problem in that survey, when I ask people what's the main problem with the material that you read, is it's too long. And when I ask people about problems with the material that they wrote, the number one problem was it's too long. So certainly fewer words is better. And then getting to the point is important. We, no matter what we write, we're used to doing things in what's called a deductive way. So I was thinking, and then here's the problem, and then here's my analysis, and then here's the solution. I'm telling people, put the solution first, mm-hmm. okay? You read in the memo, the first thing it should say is, we should drop our price by 20% and drop 3 products from the product line. What? What makes you think that?
Right.
And then you got their attention. Then you're like, okay, let me show you. Here's the analysis I did, and this is how I came to that conclusion.
You call that front loading, right?
Yes, front loading your writing. Okay. The military calls it bottom line up front bluff. It's the same thing.
Sure.
And then I get into other forms of what I call toxic prose, the jargon, the weasel words, the passive voice. These are some of the other things that we learn to do, mm-hmm. where we see all over the place, and they're not actually helping with communicating meaning.
Yeah.
Yeah. So two of the big ones I want to talk about, because I see this when I edit people's writings as a, I'm kind of in a copy chief role now. Weasel words. Mm-hmm. One, let's talk a little bit about what those are. Like, give us the ones you see over and over that we need to kill.
Yeah. So a weasel word is just any word that indicates intensity or is a qualifier, but doesn't actually have any meaning. It's vague. So for example, the number one weasel word is deeply. Mm-hmm. Right. Just let me tell you two sentences here. Here's one sentence. Okay. I hope that your listeners will get something useful out of this conversation. So there's a statement. Now here's another statement. I'm deeply committed to your listeners getting something useful out of this conversation. Means exactly the same thing. The deeply doesn't mean anything. In fact, the minute you see deeply, you know that what's going to follow is bullshit. No. And it's not just deeply, it's very, extremely, and then qualifiers, most, many. And these words, anything that doesn't actually have a quantity associated with it is basically just trying to puff things up.
Are they called weasel words because you hear them used by politicians a lot?
Yes, that's very much the case. Yes, that, I don't know, you say that, but actually there's an Australian guy who wrote a book called Weasel Words that was about how politicians talk.
Yeah, so just cut adverbs is a good start.
Adverbs are the worst, but also adjectives can be vague. Mm-hmm. And sure. You can even have nouns that are vague, like billions. Well, what does that mean? Hundreds of billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars, $1.01 billion.
The pronouns.
Well, I'm not sure. Pronouns can be vague. I don't know if I'd call them weasley.
Yeah. I see them used when you're in a train of sentences and they're trying to refer back to something and they just use a word like this.
Yeah,
you've forgotten what it was talking about.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. I don't really talk about that in the book, but I'm finding myself editing it over and over again in writing that I'm looking at in author's writing, because I'm like, whoa, wait, what are you talking about here?
Yeah, especially if you've mentioned two things in the previous paragraph, and then they start the next paragraph with this or it's.
Yeah, it's like it's connected in my mind, and you can draw that connection yourself. Anyway.
Exactly. And that's what happens. The writer, I mean, I find myself doing this all the time, knows where they're going and knows where they've been.
Yeah.
The reader doesn't, like, they're not in your head.
What? Yeah.
And we forget that.
I want to point something important out here, which is the real problem with all these toxic prose elements is repetition. Mm-hmm. So if I say to you, very is a weasel word, it is, but I'm not going to tell you, you can't use the word very in anything mm-hmm. you write, but I've analyzed some writing. One example was the email that Marissa Meyer sent to her staff after she sold Yahoo to Verizon. And there was so many of these, it was actually 6% of the words were weasel words.
Wow.
And you're reading that and you're just like, very soon you're like, you're totally full of crap. You're just making stuff up. You know, this is terrific and wonderful. And it's like, oh, you're full of shit. So this is the problem with the weasel words and with the other toxic prose elements, is that the more you use them, the less believable it is.
Yeah.
In the workshops I teach, I have an example of a page from Chipotle, you know, the Mexican food place that had the food poisoning problem.
Sure.
But they describe how they're going to fix the problem. And everything is like, you know, aggressive practices. And we've examined everything carefully and over. And you're like, if you have to try that hard, I don't believe you.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So the other big thing that I want to talk about, because I don't think most people understand this, and that is the passive voice.
Mm. Yeah.
Could you give an easy to understand explanation of passive voice?
Yes, I will.
Great.
So in a passive voice sentence, the subject of the sentence is not the actor. So, for example, this is an example my kids like to throw up at me because they know that I'm a big, if I say something like the dishwasher needs to be emptied, and they're like, Dad, that's a passive voice sentence. And it is, because the dishwasher isn't doing anything. Who's emptying the dishwasher? Well, I left that part out, and that's a passive voice sentence. You know, taxes must be lowered. Who's supposed to lower the taxes? And the simplest test is what I call the zombies test, which is if you can add the words by zombies after the verb, it's passive voice. So the dishwasher must be emptied by zombies. Okay, that makes sense. Okay, it's a passive voice sentence. If I put it in the active voice, you know, Ray, you must empty the dishwasher. You can't say you must empty the dishwasher by zombies. That doesn't make sense. Now, officially and grammatically, it has to have a form of the verb to be in it. And the subject of the sentence has to be something other than what's doing it. And that's sort of the grammatical definition. But the simplest thing is subject is not the actor, and you can add by zombies after the verb.
I like that. That's a good, easy test, easy to remember, fun. And it's actually a little fun, right, to test.
Yeah.
So it's a good, a good thing.
Getting back to, you know, politics, it's full of that stuff. Vague, you know, statements. This has got to be fixed, but not a direct statement as to who. You know, they're so good at that.
Yeah, I'll give you two examples that really show why this is a problem. One is I analyzed, and this is in the book, a series of statements that were made by a research organization that was trying to prove that the 2024 Olympics should be taking place in Boston. Now, we don't take much bullshit here in Boston, and the public was not in favor of it. And in fact, they ended up giving up on that as a result. But there were all these statements about things that would be built and, you know, that the public, you know, good must be preserved and so on. And you just realized, okay, this is a bunch of statements about stuff that has to happen, but they're not saying anything about who is doing any of this stuff. And when you start to answer those questions, you realize this isn't going to happen because the government in Boston and the private people in Boston are not actually going to do these things.
Right. Yeah.
The second example comes from early in my career. I started my career as a technical writer, and I was writing instructions on how to use software products. And technical manuals are full of passive voice. You know, the screen is refreshed, the database is repopulated. And it's very hard for people to understand because they're like, this stuff is happening, but I don't know who's doing it. And that's the problem. The repeated passive voice just creates this sort of potential in your brain where you're going,
sure,
I can't figure out what these people are talking about.
Right.
And that's why it's a problem.
Yeah.
And you said in the book that we're taught to write that way in high school and college, right?
Well, there are a number of forms that are full of the passive voice. So academic writing is full of the passive voice because God forbid that someone should take responsibility for actually having an opinion.
Exactly.
And scientific papers are written that way, right? The beaker was heated to 116 degrees and then the concentration of microbes was observed. And researchers really need to say the truth, which is I analyzed this data, not the data was analyzed. But that's in scientific papers. It's in academic journals. And
the only people that read those are the people within their,
right,
you know, or other academics.
right. Except that they taught us to write.
Yeah.
So you're in school and you're looking at examples that are written like this and you think, oh, I guess that's the way I'm supposed to write to sound sophisticated. And then you get into the business world and you write stuff like that. And your boss is like, what the hell are you talking? Who's actually supposed to pay for this? You didn't say that
right,
part.
Right. Yeah. I remember in college where I loved writing these. Do you remember the blue book tests that professors would give?
Oh, sure.
So I used to love those because you could fake your way through just about anything if you wrote a lot of bullshit, like you say. And professors would love that. Now, I mean, regardless of how much you knew and whether you were on point or not, you could fill up, you know, 4 or 5 pages of these things and they would just, you know, they would grade on, it's almost like they were grade on a curve, depending on how many words you gave them.
Yeah. But it doesn't work.
Yeah. No.
In the business world. Mm-mm.
Nope.
Right. The people who are making decisions need to know, you know, who drew this conclusion.
Exactly.
You know, I like words like expected, right. You know, stocks are expected to drop by 20%. Makes a great deal of difference who expected it, right? If you have an analyst who said that, you want to quote the analyst. If it's like you talk to 3 people who happen to be in the same house as you and they expect it, then it's bullshit.
So you have you talk about in, it's like a process, a discipline process. And most writers, I know a lot of writers don't want to think of writing as a disciplined process. They think of it as the creative process, but it really is a discipline process that you go through and give them kind of a stage by stage approach. If you could walk us through that.
I'd be happy to. And I've been teaching workshops about this, this week, and man, they're just eating this stuff up. These are people at a very large media company. And so first of all, the process that people use right now is what I call the 3 P's process. And the 3 P's are, of course, procrastinate, panic, and pray. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't tend to generate the best possible result. So the first question is, what do you do when you have a writing project, what do you do before you start writing? And when I was working on my first book, I would pass people in the hall and they'd be like, how's the writing going? And I would just look down like, I don't want to really talk about that. But I was working very hard. I was researching things. I was pulling stuff together. It was real work. It just was not writing. Right. One thing in particular I talk about is to get one thing clear before you start. It's a process I call a Rome analysis, R-O-A-M. R is readers. Who are the readers? O is objective. The objective is what are you trying to change in people's minds? A is action. What do you want them to do? And M is impression. And yes, I know impression doesn't start with M, but we got to make the acronym work. exactly. And the impression is, what will they think of you? Are you smart? Are you helping them? Are you saving them time? Are you an annoyance? Are you a pest? So if you think about that ahead of time, then when you go to write, you'll have that clear in your head. Now, what do you do with all this research? What I suggest doing is to create what I call a fat outline. And a fat outline is all of the stuff you found organized in a way that is likely to be a good organization for what you're writing. And if you just dump it in a bin, and you can put in the passive voice and the weasel words, you don't have to worry about it because it's just a bunch of stuff pasted in there. Now, when the time comes to actually write, you're not scrambling around looking for stuff. It's all there, and you can concentrate on flow. You can concentrate on making things sound like they make sense, because you're not mixing the research and the writing process.
That's a good tip. And I mean, I've always been told, you know, especially in copywriting, like do your research and then just, like you said, pour it all out, like your first draft, and then go back on your third or fourth pass. And most people, that's one of the big problems you mentioned at the beginning of the book. Like there's no editing. Even self-editing is not happening because there's so much time crunch to get the next thing out that a second pass, much less a third or fourth, is not happening.
Yeah. We're reading the first drafts of everything.
Sure. Right.
And that didn't used to be the case because there was, even in business, stuff was edited. Either you had an official editor or you had a secretary. That was one of the main things that secretaries did, was to keep executives from sounding like idiots.
Yeah.
Right. Cause they were trained, you know, they went to secretarial school and learned the stuff that we all should have been learning. Mm-hmm. But now people just type stuff out and send it. And it's very efficient for the sender and very inefficient for the poor slobs on the other end who are tempted to read it.
Which is all of us, right? Cause we're all going back and forth. So, you know, somebody's got to start, take personal responsibility and start writing leaner, cleaner,
yeah,
stronger writing.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I mean, let's say I'm going to send an email. Okay. I think about the audience, right? Okay. Who am I going to send this to? I'm going to send it to 20 of my clients. I'm going to send it to one person, but that person is my agent who I really want to get interested in this. And therefore I want to be careful what I say. I just sent an email to an editor at a very prestigious publication to try and get something published. I will go back and edit that two or three times until everything is exactly the way it needs to be. And when that person reads that, there's not going to be anything in there that shouldn't be in there.
Right.
It's going to be exactly the wording the way it ought to be, because it's important. I want it to succeed.
Yep.
Yeah. I had a case this week at work where, you know, luckily I was reading your book, mm-hmm, and a client was asking for like a partial credit on their monthly retainer fee. And, I had to write a response because there was, you know, there was trouble on both sides. Right?
Yeah, this is challenging.
Yes. Yeah. So that, you know, they're asking for hard dollars. So mm-hmm, literally the response was worth thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. And I took my time. I went ahead and told them, hey, we're looking into this. I'm looking into this personally because this is my department. I'll get back. I went ahead and pushed it out so I knew, mm-hmm, I could have time to edit. Not to, like, I kind of knew what happened already.
Yeah.
I needed time to craft the message to give the best possible story and outcome. And the good news is it seems like after that letter, they're not going to ask for that money after all. So it was worth it. So, and I picked up some tips from your book while doing that. So.
Yeah. You could have saved yourself an hour by just sending the first thing you thought of, but
yeah,
probably would have cost you a few $1,000 Absolutely. When they were like, exactly, oh, I don't have to deal with this. This guy doesn't have a very good argument. So what?
Yeah. And it damages the relationship long-term because now they think they can do that whenever they want.
Yep. Oh yeah. Right? It's worth $1,000 this month and another few thousand dollars next month.
Exactly. And there's little micro, I don't think people understand how those little micro things add up over the life of a customer, life of a relationship, and erodes trust or makes you push over or anything else.
Yeah. Well, that's why the last element of the Rome thing I described is impression, mm-hmm, because everything that you write says something about you. Like PR people used to send me stuff over and over again. And I'm like, not only do I not believe this, but you are teaching me that you, the PR person, are a huge time waster and useless. I can't resist saying this. I don't want to get political here, mm-hmm, but I was on a workshop call with 20 people in Asia. So these are people from Japan, Taiwan, Thailand, India, Korea, Australia too. And I mentioned this Rome thing and they're like, can you give me an example of, you know, the impression that people make? And I'm like, oh, how am I going to give an example that they'll know about in these Asian countries? So I said, think about all of the president's tweets. Now, whether you love Trump or you hate Trump, you have to admit that after thousands of tweets, you have a pretty good idea who he is and what he stands for. And right, there I was talking to a bunch of people who were half a world away, and they all nodded their heads like, oh, yeah, I see what you mean. And it doesn't, you know, they'll never forget that. And I don't want your listeners to either, that this idea that if you repeatedly behave in a certain way, then people will think of you that way.
Sure. Yeah.
I will say, I mean, if I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, like, Trump doesn't use the passive voice much. He's pretty direct in that.
Just thinking about that.
Well,
he always blames somebody.
Yes, it's interesting. I wrote a lot about him. My plan when I launched the book, which my marketing plan was that I would be analyzing the bullshit heavy election season because the book came out right around the 2016 election.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I was pitching this a year ahead of that election and, mm-hmm, I had no idea. The problem was that there was so much analysis flying around that you know, that and analyzing Trump's communication was, I was not the only one doing it, believe me.
Sure.
Right.
But I had a post, one of the first posts when he first announced was called "The Batshit Candor of Donald Trump." And the thing is, he's his ability to string together clear sentences has deteriorated since then.
Yeah.
But you're right. There's a certain directness that we're not used to from politicians, a certain informality and directness.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The challenge is when you look at it and you're like, well, did he actually really say that?
Right.
And this is the thing, is that most politicians don't say the things that scare the hell out of people, because they know better, and Trump doesn't know any better, and he just says exactly what he's thinking.
Or or you could take the other side and say he knows his base really well.
Yeah.
You could say that. I guess we're going to find out soon just how big that base is and how much of it is left.
Right. So speaking of like big narratives.
Yeah.
How do you think the information being, you know, put out about this whole COVID thing, just in general, not any one person, not any one organization, just how do you see, you have to have an opinion on that and like how it's coming out and what are you seeing?
So this is a great example of the first draft problem. So there are a few things. First of all, I'm really surprised at how facts are squishy. So things like infection rates and death rates, in Florida, they told medical examiners that they couldn't report the causes of death the way that they were. So there's a lot of fighting over the facts, and you would think that that's something that we could agree on. We might not agree on the strategies, but we should agree on the facts.
Right.
The interesting thing is that the science, which is where you would normally think you could depend on things, well, the science is, I mean, I believe the scientists. Mm-hmm. The scientists say, you know, this spreads in a certain way, mm-hmm. and it has a certain infection rate. That's sort of scary. Mm-hmm. But a lot of what's been written about potential cures hasn't gone through the normal scientific process of vetting and peer review and so on.
Sure.
And for example, this hydroxychloroquine thing, they wrote about this in the New York Times Magazine recently. The guy who was first producing the research on it, it basically was like, we tried this and it cured everybody. Mm-hmm. But you go back and look at the research and they were like, well, we eliminated several people because they died. And you're like, okay, well, then they weren't cured, were they? And as
they were cured.
Yes, well, that's true. They don't have the disease anymore because they're in the ground. Mm-hmm. And as time has gone on, and then there's a study that came out just before this broadcast that basically was like, well, actually, not only doesn't it help, but people are much more likely to get to have heart problems and die from it.
Sure.
And it's like, well, that means we can't trust the science. Well, the problem is that the normal scientific processes have been short-circuited because everyone's so desperate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, you're seeing what it's like at the leading edge of science, which is sometimes you can't be sure whether things are true. We haven't really figured it out.
Right.
Right. And most people aren't willing to say that and be direct and blunt because that doesn't play well on media, period.
Well, here's a good example is this vaccine that's under development. Moderna, which is a company that's based right here in Boston, has a really innovative idea for a vaccine, and there's really encouraging results coming out. Some people in politics are saying, see, this means we'll be able to have vaccines in large quantities in January. Well, there's an awful lot of stuff that has to happen between now and then for that to be the case. And people like Fauci are like, well, I don't think you can count on that. And the fact is, optimism is a very dangerous thing here.
Yeah.
And we're in developing stuff that hasn't been developed before. And the right answer is it's very hard to know, but people don't really want to hear it's very hard to know right now. They want an answer.
Yeah.
Right.
And they want a simple answer because everything's so convoluted. Because, you know, Sean and I have been talking. We've been going through another book recently called Thinking Fast and Slow. So we talk about the two systems of thinking, you know, the system one, system two. System one thinking is where we have a tendency by nature to want to take the path of least resistance. That's human nature pretty much. So we want easy solutions or we want easy answers to everything. So I think that people, when the messages are so convoluted and there's so many things coming from different ways and the research is so convoluted, we tend to go after, okay, what's the simplest thing? What's the clear, you know, the clearest answer that we see is available. And somebody mentions hydroxychloroquine or something like that and automatically says, oh, this is an answer. So they're like, okay, great.
Well, yeah. We have, I'm not sure whether it's covered in that book, but we're really bad at understanding risk.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Sure.
So, think about wearing a mask versus not wearing a mask. Well, if everybody wears a mask, then we might be able to reduce the risk of getting cases, but there will still be cases.
Sure.
And if everybody doesn't wear a mask, then 2 weeks later, things might be worse.
Yeah.
But for me individually, whether I wear a mask or not, is probably not going to make a difference. It might, but I can't be like, if I wear a mask, I'll be fine. If I don't, I won't be fine.
Yeah.
So we just can't get our heads around that. And yet, the solution, regrettably, is to believe your government.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in Vietnam, they're like, everybody has to wear a mask, right? People are like, I guess we do, right? Whereas here, we get mixed messages from different people, and some of it's considered to be political, and people are like, nah, I should be able to do what I want.
Right.
So, you know, a free democratic society isn't really doing very well with just trust the scientists and your governor. Sure. They're not really happy with that.
Right.
Yeah. For good reason in a lot of cases, right? Because trust has been eroded over the years. Weasel words and because of, you know, overladen writing and everything else.
Yeah. I mean, our governor here in Massachusetts used to be the president of a health insurance company. And in fact, I actually did a workshop for that health insurance company and I met him at the time. And I was like, this guy's pretty smart. And so he's actually coming from a position of knowledge. And even though this is a Democratic state and he's a Republican governor, there's been a sort of communication that's relatively clear and nuanced.
Sure.
And people are going along with that. But there's a lot of governors who don't really have that level of trust or level of knowledge.
Yeah.
So we're getting short on time. So I want to get Josh, unless you have something else, Jonathan, but I wanted to get kind of what's the big takeaways besides buy the book and read it, which we recommend everyone do. What's kind of the big three takeaways people can, or even one like big takeaway they can walk away and start applying to their writing?
Okay. So you want three takeaways. I'll give you three takeaways. One is bottom line up front. Give me in the first few sentences in the title, I can't emphasize enough how much titles and subject lines matter. And then the first few sentences after that, tell me the answer. Tell me the most important thing. And you know what? If I don't keep reading after that, because I don't need to hear that, then you've actually saved me time.
Yeah.
Second thing is this toxic prose elements, the weasel words, the passive voice, the jargon. The problem there is repetition. The more you get yourself sensitive to these things and remove them from writing as you edit things, the clearer they're going to get. And the third is to have this deliberate process of understanding your audience and your objective with any piece before you start, doing the research separately, and then going through and actually writing only when you've got all that other material in place. And if people can just internalize those sorts of things, they will they'll see a significant amount of improvement in the clarity of what they're doing.
There's one chapter that I highlighted a lot, chapter 21, on email thoughtfully. Because I deal with a lot of, in the industry that I work with, I email and communicate with a lot of engineers in the automotive manufacturing industry. Mm-hmm. So it's so important. I mean, so much of this book applies to that because, as you know, engineers, they don't want the fluff. They want the, they want you kind of to get to the point and mm-hmm. not use a lot of those weasel words. But you had a great example that I have applied to a lot of emails, and you actually put it here in the, you know, in the chapter of just how you, one of the, you know, how to get a clear subject line, be mm-hmm. simple, clear on your subject line, get to the point really quickly. Again, get to your point so you're not using a lot of fluff. But it's funny that I took like your headline or your subject line, and when I emailed you to be a part of the podcast, mm-hmm. I used exactly the subject line you used in that, except I just substituted. So in the example email, you're communicating with someone and you said, you know, would you like to, or would like to interview you for my book?
Yeah.
So I simply use, would like to interview you for our podcast. So, you know, and that's an example of just being clear and to the point in your subject line so that people know exactly, because we're inundated with emails all the time. And so yeah, something and like that
worked.
Stands
I'm
out.
Here, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It worked. So that, I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's a clear example of how, you know, that was put into practice and that works.
Great, great. I don't know how many different techniques and tactics there are. There's a lot in here. So I recommend everybody get the book. And can you, Josh, mention your website again?
Yeah. So if people, it depends. If you're shy, you can just type in my last name, burnoff.com. Mm-hmm. If you're bold, you can type in withoutbullshit.com. Goes the same place. And every weekday I'm posting about communication, about books and writing, and about all sorts of things about influence, all the stuff that I've learned over all that time as an analyst and from helping people with writing and editing right now.
So if I'm on your website, it says subscribe to blog via email. Will that give me the blog in my email every day?
It will get you a notice about the blog in okay. your email. And the other thing is I don't do snippets. When you read those first three sentences, those are the first three sentences of the post, and you'll know right away if right. you want to read that or not.
Great. Awesome.
Well, we'll be sure to post a link to that. I'll tell you, you know, Sean, I was just thinking, because last week we had one of our guests that joined us last week was a guy named David Seed. He is the founder of a company called Minibook, and mm-hmm. we didn't plan this, obviously, but it kind of works out pretty cool because the whole premise of, you know, that interview, this guy, they published like little short pocket sized books. I mean, these are like mm-hmm. 32, 64 pages mm-hmm. and it was a fascinating interview. And I've worked with their company before in publishing some books, but these are small pocket sized books. And the whole purpose of them is to get your message across super clear, easy, without the fluff. And so I thought, man, this is pretty cool that we followed that interview up with, you know, these short, purposeful books that get straight to the point that are, they're intended for specific topics and then have you on to kind of, to follow up on that, to be very focused on, you know, and simple in your writing. Those two go hand in hand, I think.
Yeah. So if you want to write a mini book, buy Josh's book first so you can write your mini book.
That's right. So you can write the mini book.
And you can write, you can read my book. Those chapters are only, 2,000-3,000 words long.
Right.
Yeah.
Shorter in some cases. So think of it as 30 mini books glued together.
Absolutely. And then in 1 month, treat it like a writing devotional mm-hmm. for 1 month.
Yeah, there you go. Okay.
Whoa, that's a good idea. I never thought of that.
Yeah, there you go. That's Josh. My copywriter marketing brain kicking in.
Josh, it's been a pleasure, man. We really enjoyed having you on. Thanks again. And we'd love to do it again sometime. Again, we'll be posting a link. The link that you mentioned, we'll be posting out on our webpage and we'll have this out here in a couple of days. We look forward to getting out to our listeners and hope you have a great weekend.
Okay, thanks. It was great to be on and participate with you.
Thanks so much. Enjoyed it.
Bye-bye.